Before we get started with the next sales cycle module that I call fact finding, I think it's important that I define what fact finding is and also what fact finding is not as it relates to its own sales cycle. So what we're talking about is this is the very first interaction with a new prospective client. That could be on the phone, that could be over a video conference, or that could be and hopefully is face to face. And in the fact finding module, I'm talking about after just a brief amount of small talk, what you begin to do is tell the client what you do, how you do it, and why you do it. I define that as the approach that might be three and a half minutes at most. And then you're right into the in-depth fact finder, where you are asking a lot of questions and gathering a tremendous amount of information. It's important that you now understand what fact finding is not, and that is a feel it out meeting, or some people call it an approach meeting. In other words, I've met many advisors that feel in their mind, the goal of the first interaction with the client is to sell themselves. So they'll go into a meeting and they will do just that. They will try to sell themselves. They'll talk about how they do what they do, why they do, and then they will leave to come back later in time to gather all of the information. I am adamant about that is not a good use of your time. So to be clear, before we dive into this module, what a fact-finding meeting means to me is that you're going for the first time, briefly telling somebody your approach and going right into the meeting. And anywhere between 60 and 90 minutes from then, you walk away knowing everything there is to know about that prospective client. I just wanted to be clear before we got started. So as we begin the very first step of the sales cycle module of fact finding, I believe with the majority of people that I teach, it's the most difficult one. It is the one that requires you to leave your needs at the door. And when you're in the meeting, giving your gift of being fully present to the individual that you're working with. When they feel as if nothing else in the world matters in that one meeting that they're with you, and that you give them the gift of your presence, that is monumental in building a relationship going forward. But the second reason this is important is because the meeting's not about you, or at least it shouldn't be about you. When you have faith in your system and your process, your last mindset before you walk in a meeting should be, how do I really understand this individual so that once I do, I can really help this individual, so that once I do that, I can feel that the work I do matters and makes a difference. That should be your mindset. Your mindset should not be, how do I sell this person something? And if you're going into a meeting thinking, what do I need to do to sell something? Then the meeting's about you. And that's not what it is that I teach at all. So therefore, hanging in there, having the faith and trusting your process in your system. When you go in and you seek to understand their story, you understand that the majority of people out there have multiple needs in their financial planning, that ultimately that your system and your process will help them meet all of their needs, and your benefits will be ancillary and will also be amazingly abundant. So good luck with this one. I believe it starts with just your level of awareness, both before you go in the meeting and when you walk out, sizing yourself up and seeing how you did. So as we go into the second step of the Fact Finder module, I want to pause a bit and I want you to make an assumption. This assumption won't be true 100% of the time, but I think you will really benefit if you assume it is. And the assumption I want you to make is what a mindset is of a prospective client right before they begin a meeting with you, whether that's at a restaurant or in an office or whatever, right before that moment of the initial handshake, that what is going on in their mind is, why did I agree to this meeting? This person's just gonna try to sell me something that I don't want or need. How quickly can I get out of this meeting? I can't believe I agreed to be in this meeting in the first place. And that's the mindset that I want you to feel every single prospective new client has when you first greet them. However, what I also want you to have as a goal is within 3.5 to 5 minutes, no longer than that, that their after mindset is, holy cow, this is totally different than I have ever seen before. This is not what I was anticipating. I wish I would have met this person a lot sooner. And how you are going to take the before mindset to the after mindset is through the approach, which is the second step of the sales cycle. So let's talk about that briefly. When I talk about the approach, what I'm talking about is when you first get to a meeting and you are sitting down with them, and after just a little bit of small talk, you're gonna now tell this prospective client what you do, how you do it, and the benefit of working with you. However, what's really important is it has to be full of DNA. And when I say that, what I mean is different, new, and attractive. Let's face it, for the most part in the industry, an individual will go through with a financial advisor essentially a three-step approach. What they'll do is they'll go in the first step and gather a bunch of information, and then they'll leave. And then they'll come back in the second meeting and they'll present a plan and some solutions and ideas to sell. And then in the third step and third meeting, they'll try to get back together with that client on an annual basis. If you explain to your client that that's what you do, it's no different than what they expected, and it's no different than what they've already heard a number of times. So you have to do it in a way that's full of DNA. My theory is that after that approach, very rarely, a day later, for some people, maybe even an hour later, will they really remember what exactly it is that you said. However, what they will remember for a long time is how you made them feel. And your approach needs to be designed that effectively does this. So imagine the power of going from the prior mindset to the post mindset in 3.5 or 4, 5 minutes. That is a powerful approach. And it's important that when you put this thing together, that you bring a lot of intentionality to that. So the next step for you with the approach is to come up with your own. And what I suggest you do to do that is for you to be able to sit down and outline it, bullet point it. Ask yourself the first question, what you do, and write that down. And second of all, ask yourself, how do you do it, and write that down. And last but not least, write out, what is the benefit of working with you? And then once you have that in a bullet point outline format, then you can work on wordsmithing it, and then you can work on articulating it in a way that has purpose and passion and power. And so you're gonna see me here in a minute do it, but I would recommend that although that should give you an idea of what the end product should look like, it will be more authentic if you create your own. That way I think you will personalize it, you will own it. That one that you're gonna see now will give you an idea, but when you go back and write your own, it'll be much more individualized to you. So good luck in your approach, and I would encourage you to spend considerable time practicing and practicing and practicing it. So I want to talk about a couple of the significant benefits of a really, really good approach. First and foremost, let's be really clear that in one of the greatest things that you can have to grow your business is to increase your level of self-confidence. What I have found is there are very few things, if anything, that is more directly correlated to the growth of one's self-confidence to the master of their language and the commitment of that. There are a few other areas of language that I emphasize as well, but this approach is clearly one of them. If you have this down, that it's the same every time, and you don't even have to think about what you're saying, and you can focus on how you deliver it and all the nonverbal aspects of communication, it strengthens your level of confidence, it makes you more attractive, and it is much easier to really focus on the individual that you're talking to when you're not thinking about what you're saying. The other thing too is you become a master of it when you do it repetitively over and over and over and over again. If the opposite of which, every time you go see a new prospective client, you're sharing some different things, the power is not there as if it's the same every time. So what I'm asking you to do is to be committed to this, you know, to grab your iPhone, to film yourself, to test it and tweak it all the time. If it right now is either A, non-existent, or B, authentically measured on a scale of 0 to 10 of a 2 or a 3, and you can put some time into getting it to an 8 or a 9, it will have an insurmountable impact in a positive way on your practice. So really go deep on this one, and I wish you the best of luck. So now, after our approach, we're gonna start with the first section of the Fact Finder. And because Fact Finders are so different in the industry from company to company to company, I wanna be really clear on what I'm referring to when I say the introduction. It's where you're talking about and asking and listening around things like their family, their hobbies and their interests, their career, and their future vision for their career. And we're asking them questions to better understand them before we're diving into real financial concepts. So that first section of the Fact Finder is where we want to be really focused on 3 critical feelings that we want our clients to feel. The first is that when we walk out of there, we want them to say, boy, that financial rep really cares about me. The second thing we want to have happen and we want them to feel is that financial rep really, really understands me. And the third thing is that rep really is knowledgeable. They know what they're doing. So therefore, in order to do that, I want you to stop winging it. And I want you to be intentional about the questions that you ask, that first and foremost are so that you can better understand them, so that you can better help them. But the other thing now is that we know if we want them to feel those 3 things, we've got to ask questions that are in alignment with those feelings. So now let's go into some examples of some of these questions. But before I do so, let me tell you how critically important it is. If you remember where we're at now, we took maybe 3 and a half minutes to do our approach, which we just finished. And now we're going into this first section of the Fact Finder. And we want to engage this individual very, very quickly. And we want them to feel, wow, this is very different. The most powerful thing you can do in sales is not telling, is not selling, is not giving great ideas. It's asking powerful questions that make people think and that differentiate you, because one of their immediate thoughts is, that's a great question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. So therefore, let's get started. I just got done saying the approach to this new prospective client, and I'm about ready to ask them my first question. Here's one that worked really well for me. I'd say, so Mr. Prospect, because I'm in the financial planning business, it's really important for me to understand what money means to you. So my first question for you today is, go back to your earliest childhood memory and tell me, what did you learn about money by observing mom and dad? And then if I feel I need to ask a clarifying question or 2 or 3, I'll keep going on that. If I feel they told me what I wanted to hear or needed to hear, I should say, then I will stop with that. And then I'll go into the second question. But before I give you the second question, let me tell you a very strong opinion I have around it. And that is that how a husband and wife communicate around money, first of all, is a big deal in their marriage. And second of all, it's critical for you as a financial advisor to understand. And so therefore, if both of them are in the room together, you can ask them this while they're there. But if one of them is just there, I would simply say this. So tell me, Mr. or Mrs. Prospect, if you were to go home tonight, based on the meeting we had today, and you and your spouse were sitting at the kitchen table discussing your finances, if I was a fly on the wall, tell me, what would I observe? And then you listen to their answers there. I promise you that nobody has ever asked that individual those two questions. They will be taken back by it. They will have to think about it, and you will be different, you will be new, and you will be attractive. The next set of questions I like to go in is around their career. There are several reasons for this. However, the foundational reason for all of these is I'm trying to better understand them. I really want to get to know them. So that, let's just make that clear. But after that, number one, I find that people love talking about, you guessed it, themselves. And very, very rarely do people get to talk about their career with anybody. And so I like to give them the opportunity to do that. And I also learn a lot about the individual. So some of the questions I will ask around the career are the basic ones, above and beyond just the title. So tell me, you know, I understand that you are vice president at this bank, but what do you really do? And then I'll hang in there and ask maybe one or two or three more questions beyond that. What do you love about that? What don't you love about that? If you were to be able to get rid of 20% of the stuff you hate, what would that look like? Tell me a little bit about what you're really passionate about when you're doing it. So those are just a few questions around helping them tell you about what they really do. The goal here I teach is to be able to find out information that you cannot find on the internet, on their LinkedIn or on their Facebook. On their LinkedIn, I know that they're vice president of such and such a bank. I might even know a further title than that. But I don't know what they absolutely love or what they absolutely can't stand. I also want to know about their environment in their career. Who do you report to? Is that the next step for you? What are the odds that 5 years from now you'll still be here? If you're not in this world, where will you be? So that I can learn a little bit more about their vision. That also gives me a lot of insight into how happy they are, into how big they think. And then an ancillary benefit to that, as I taught in prospecting, is it also gives me names to feed about people who are their coworkers that are at their level or even higher than them. So those are some of the questions I like to ask as it relates to a career. So before we go to the last section in the introduction, around hobbies and fun, I want to tell you that it's a real healthy balance. In other words, one extreme isn't good, the other extreme isn't good. You have to find the middle of the road. And the one extreme is if you spend a half an hour talking about hobbies and interest. Because what I find more often than not is people don't care all that much. And so if they've just met you, they have no real connection, they're really not interested in you telling them all about your golf game or your hunting and fishing excursions or what wine you like. So it can be to what I would say extreme. At the same extent, I want to be able to learn how to relate to this person. And I also think I can get to know them better by spending a good amount of time in it that's good enough. But before I start, let me just tell you what I believe. And what I believe is that you can learn a lot about a person if all you do is look at their calendar and their checkbook. Because what people spend their money on and what people spend their time on is what really matters to them. So the way that I would go into this question with my clients is I'd say, you know what, Mr. Prospect, I've learned over time? You can learn a lot about people just by taking a look at their checkbook and their calendar. Because where they spend their money and where they spend their time says a lot about what's very meaningful to them. So, having said that, if I were to take a look at your checkbook and I were to take a look at your calendar, tell me, what would I learn about you? And people like talking about that. And so that's a fun little exercise that also adds some energy early on in the meeting. However, I also want to find briefly and hopefully something I can relate to. If they were to say to me, well, if you took a look at my checkbook, you'd see that I spend quite a bit of money on wine. And then I might say, what's your favorite bottle? And I probably know a little bit about that, so I can make a brief comment on it. Or if you took a look at my calendar, you'd see that I play a lot of golf. Where do you like to play? That's also a passion of mine. You can kind of see where I'm going. If they say that, you know, you look at my checkbook and my calendar, you'll see that my wife and I love fine dining. We love going out to nice restaurants. In your particular city, you might say, what's number one? And if you've been there, you can have a brief dialogue around it. So in summary, as it relates to hobbies and fun, I think it creates energy for people to talk about it. I think they really enjoy that. I'm also looking for areas that I can relate to. And last but not least, it also gives me some categories that I can feed later on in prospecting if that's what I choose to do. So learn some good questions in that section for you. But I do believe it's important for you to understand your clients' fun part of their life as well. Now let's move into the education goal section of the Fact Finder. This is where you're engaging with your clients that have young children or are about to have a child or are planning one sooner rather than later. And you're discussing with them how important college education is and the financial subsidies and them helping their children with that. And so when we do that, one of the things that's really important to figure out is if they do want to contribute, if this is important to them and they state that, we want to at least understand is what it is that they're thinking in their mind. Is it fairly realistic and is it possible? Is it achievable? I'll give an example of what's not. If you meet a client that has a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, and because you just got done going through their entire balance sheet, you're already privy to the fact that there are no assets as of yet assigned to college, and they tell you that they want to educate those two children. That's probably not realistic. The oldest is 3 years away from going to college. They probably needed to start some time ago, and we're going to need to have a dialogue around that. The second thing that you want to do with them is you want to make sure that you are able to ascertain how important what they tell you is. On one extreme can be wishful thinking. On the other extreme could be, I will run through a brick wall to make this happen. And so I believe those elements are really important. And so therefore, in order to do that, you've got to learn how to ask really good questions. Because of the fact that I find that, especially with very young children, most parents are fairly naive as to exactly what college is going to cost, and they don't really know a lot about it until their children get pretty close to that age. So a lot of times what I'll start out by saying is, tell me, where did you go to school? How much does that school cost today? They may know, they may not know. However, I think this is a good entry level to the educational desires that they have. The next thing I want to go into is asking them when they went to school, how was their education paid for? Who paid for it? How did that play out? I want to go even a little bit further in depth there with the question to the question to the question. If they tell me that they paid for it, I want to know a little bit more about that. You know, it's one thing to say that, I had three jobs during college and I graduated with no loans, versus I didn't work at all in college and I borrowed all the money and it took me 20 years to pay it off and now it's finally paid off. I want to know the details of those stories. I want to know how it makes them feel when they tell that story. Some of my clients would say that, you know, my parents could have easily planned for it. They never did. I was very burdened for the first 10 years of my career paying massive student loans, and I don't want to put my children in that same situation. Other people will tell me that, you know, their parents had plenty of money and purposely didn't pay for all their education because they wanted them to appreciate it and feel like they earned it. So maybe they split it 50-50. Whatever their story is, I want to know it. And I want to know how that played out for them. And then last but not least, I want to ask them, what is your strategy for funding the gap? And see what they have to say. This is an example of selling and telling less and asking great questions. If somebody's got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old and they tell me how important education is, but yet they have yet to open up an account, I want to know, when's your plan to start? What do you think you're going to do about that? And see what they can tell me. Those questions will give you great insight as to how important it is. And also when they tell you what school they went to, you probably should have a good idea to tell them ballpark today, this is what that costs. and they can be on the same wavelength as you in terms of what amount of dollars you're talking about. So good luck with those questions. Before we go deep on the fact-finding module, I think it's important that we go up to 30,000 feet and just be clear on what exactly is a fact-finder interview in terms of breaking it down. And I think that's important because across the industry, there's so many different forms and so many different ways that people gather information that you will find this helpful. So the first compartment of a fact finder is the approach. That's where you're telling that client, prospective client, what you do, how you do it, why you do it. And then you start to go into your fact finder. The next compartment is what I call the introduction. And what that is where you're getting to know them personally, around their family, their career, their hobbies and their interests and their future visions and their plans. And then the next compartment of a fact finder is, let's call it data gathering, where you're getting a bunch of information, things like a balance sheet, assets and liabilities, benefits through work in disability insurance, life insurance, 401k data, and so on and so forth. That's all in data gathering. And then you're going to goal sections. The first goal would be education. Another goal section would be retirement. Another goal section would be survivor income. And another goal section would be disability income. And then last but not least would be the last compartment is discovery agreement. And that's where you're taking everything that you just learned in that meeting and you are summarizing it in a discovery agreement right before you leave. So those are all the compartments that I teach, and I thought it was important before we did so to start at 30,000 feet and just be crystal clear on what those compartments were. Now to the retirement section. In the retirement section, I like to teach this analogy because I find that what you believe needs to be communicated and felt to these prospective clients. So when I'm getting into the retirement section, I'll use this analogy with my clients. I'll say, you know what, Mr. or Mrs. Prospect, retirement planning and the assets that you build are kind of like an engine, and I like to call them a retirement engine. And here's the deal. Over, let's just say, a 40-year career, you get to build that engine any way you want. Let's assume you start at about 25 working in your life, and you retire about 65. We've got 40 years to build our engine. And you can build any kind of engine you want. You can build a 4-cylinder, a 6-cylinder, a 12-cylinder. You can put as much horsepower into that thing as you want. It's your choice. But here's the deal. The day you walk into the sunset and retire, your engine is built. And so you can no longer change the spark plugs. You can't fill it up with gas. You can't oil it. It is done. And you turn down and you start the engine and you ride that engine for the rest of your retirement. It is what it is. And so I don't stop there because that helps paint a picture, a visual, if you may, but where I would really use it to help create some sense of urgency with my clients as it relates to their retirement planning is because I would find that it's very difficult for, let's say, a 35-year-old to be remotely focused on retirement. To most 35-year-olds, they feel like retirement is, you know, so far out in advance they can't even think about it. They're so focused on surviving today with young children, trying to make a way in their career, that that's the least thing on their mind. But if you are in this business, you understand that the compounding of a dollar is like the eighth wonder of the world, and that starting early is critically important. And so I would use this story to be able to spur a sense of energy and urgency around it. So after I told them what I've already told you, then I would say this. I don't know if you know this, Mr. Prospect, but you get about 40 years to build your engine. You're currently 35 years old. The bad news is that 25% of your engine is already built, and we can never go back and change it. The good news is we still have 75% to go. That hits home with a lot of people, especially if they know, in brutal honesty, that the first 25% looks pretty bleak, that they didn't do a good job whatsoever. And so I hope that helps you as it relates to an analogy as you begin your retirement section. So when we get into the retirement dialogue in the Fact Finder interview, we need to be able to get these clients to tell us about what does retirement mean to them. The basics are, what age do you want to retire? What kind of lifestyle do you want at retirement? What income is it going to take to provide that? Now, if you're talking to somebody who's 50, 55, 60 years old, there's a lot of energy around that because those people think about it a lot and are pretty clear about what they want. But if you're talking to, let's just say, a 35-year-old or a 30-year-old, you know, more often than not, they don't have a clue what they want to do because they don't think about that. But your job is to get them to understand the importance of thinking about it, and it is no longer okay for them to procrastinate. And so therefore, what you want to do is have some realistic dialogue around that. And if through that dialogue, you can get them to conclude numbers that are meaningful, you know, that's really helpful. More often than not, a client would say to me, Jim, I have no idea. What do most of your clients do? And then I can just default to what most financial surveys tell us, and that is that if you can retire at age 65 and you can have 75% of your pre-retirement income adjusted for inflation until your life expectancy, you've done a pretty good job. Does that sound good to you? And then I would get that client to say, yeah, let's use that. So now I've at least established a stake in the ground of what is our goal. I know what they're making now. I want to plug in 75% of that, and I want to take them to 65 and do that. But more importantly, that is the logical side of the conversation. What I now want to know is everybody has multiple retirement stories. If they're super young, it's through grandma and grandpa. But once they hit adult life and they're old enough to see their mom and dad retire, or perhaps their in-laws retired, I want to know what they've learned by observing that. You know, have they seen high stress? Have they seen poor health? Have they seen difficult issues in their life because of lack of planning? Or the opposite, where they've seen a wonderful life because of the fact that they planned a lot. But I want them to tell me a story or two of what they've learned about what retirement is through close family members. Because this will start to emotionally connect the dots for them and get the desire to get started sooner rather than later. So we want to get a reasonable age, a reasonable income, and we want to get a story behind the numbers so that we can better understand them. So in the retirement section, I want to give you some really good questions that I used to better understand my clients. And at the same time, I also want to tell you about a couple of situations that I believe are highly likely that you will incur, and I want to coach you as to what you should be doing when you incur those situations. So the first question I would ask is about mom and dad, and I just simply say, are mom and dad still living? Are they retired? Tell me about their retirement. Is it a healthy retirement? Did they do a good job of planning? If so, what do you think contributed to that? If they're unhealthy financially, I want to know, what do you think contributed to that? I want to ask them, what have they learned from that? What have they observed from that? What's really interesting is when you get a married couple and you have them talk about their parents and their in-laws, and what are the differences or the similarities between the two of them? What are the habits and what are the things that growing up they observe they want to absolutely do that their parents and in-laws did? Or that they want to absolutely avoid. And having a dialogue around that puts a sense of human touch to retirement planning and also can help them start to create a better sense of urgency around really starting to get this thing going and start planning. So those are hopefully some good questions for you around that. The two situations that I found I would incur occasionally, one more than the other, One would be where somebody says, oh, Jim, I'm never retiring. First of all, I love what I do. And second of all, I don't really have that many hobbies. I can't play golf every day. I can't sit and read every day. Oh, and by the way, I watched my dad and my grandpa retire and die 2 years later. And I just don't want to do that. And I think it's at that point in time that you should share with them what I shared with my clients. And I would say, I understand that, but let me tell you my definition of retirement. My definition is where you wake up and you're going to work every single day because you love what you do, not because you need a paycheck. And I think it would be prudent for you to be in a situation where you have that option. So as your advisor, I'm suggesting that we pick an age where if you choose to work for the rest of your life, that's awesome, but it's not because you have to. And I would get most clients to agree to that. The other one would be where somebody would say, typically in their young, early years and not very happy doing what they're doing, like, I'm out of here at 50, Jim, I'm done. I do not like this rat race whatsoever. And with that individual, what you've got to do is you've got to be able to put a sense and a dose of being realistic into their mind. That you should have by then a fairly good idea of what they're spending, their burn rate, so to speak, their assets and what they have or have not already saved. And you can help them by kind of holding up a mirror, understand that in order for that to be remotely possible, they'd have to save close to 80 or 90% of their income now to even come close to making that happen. We want to get that person to understand that that's probably not good to plan, because then the plan we're going to put together is going to be totally unrealistic. And what we really want to make sure through this section, other than understanding them and the emotional piece, is that we've got a real good stake in the ground for a goal, that they own it, they buy into it, and we feel it's realistic. And I think that's how I would handle both of those situations. So now we enter the survivor income section of the Fact Finder, or some just simply call it the life insurance section of the Fact Finder. In this section, it really comes down to two overall objectives. The first objective, what we want to do is find out what they have and everything you can imagine about that. And then the second thing we want to find out is what it is they would want to achieve if, God forbid, they were to die today with the people that they love and care about in their life. So let's start with what they have. What's really important is that we understand in a very deep way everything there is to understand about the choices or lack thereof that they've made in this area. Let's say, for example, at their work, they have some group life insurance. And let's just say that we find out through asking that they could have elected up to a maximum of 7 times their income, but yet they elected 2. 1 time came for free. You want to know, why did you elect 3? Why not 2? Why not 4? Why not 7? How did you come up with that decision? Then you also want to know if they have something independently on their own that they own. What kind is it? Is it term? Is it whole life? Is it universal? Obviously, what is the face amount of it? But more importantly is, how did you come to that decision? Who helped you make that decision? What process did they use? How long has it been since you've updated it? And you want to know how they feel about it, and so on and so forth. So hanging in there and asking a lot of questions is going to get them to really open up and for you to better understand them. So now let's go to the unfortunate case of if something were to happen to them and they don't make it home tonight, what are their goals and objectives? In the most simplistic format, there's really 3. The first is paying off debt reduction. The second is paying for college costs for children. That's the second one. And then the third one is income replacement. Let's start with debt. That is what it is. It's the easiest one. Whatever their car loans are, their student loans are, their mortgages are, their credit card debt, whatever their debt is, we want enough life insurance to make sure that there's a clean slate there. The next one, college education, is fairly simple as well. Here's what I used. Let's just say, for example, they have a 3-year-old child and they say in today's dollars, they want to fund 4 years of college, and the college that they went to, they just want to use that one. And we look it up in today's dollars, that's $25,000 a year for 4 years is $100,000. What we put into the plan is that if something happened to that individual tonight and we had $100,000 set aside, that when invested appropriately, that would keep up with the education inflation rate and be able to educate that three-year-old child when they're 18 at that university. So that's pretty straightforward and simple. The third one is income replacement. The biggest eye-opener I get in the field when I'm training in this area is around income replacement. I don't think it's done very well. I think more often than not, it's totally ignored and it's critically important. So when we look at the income replacement section, I want to take a step back. Remember when we were going through the income section of the Fact Finder and I taught you that it was really important that you learn the client's burn rate, what they spend per month? Here's where that comes into play as well, in addition to what I already taught you. You see, before they met you that day, they didn't know what that number was. And if you're doing a very good job in that, they now do know what that number is. So that will be a huge benefit that you can use here. So before I teach you how I want you to do this, I want to teach you how I don't want you to do this. So once you get the debt number that you mutually agree on, once you get the college education that you mutually agree on, I don't want you to say, "So, Mr. Prospect, the third area is income replacement. How much would you like to leave to your wife?" Because they will give you an answer that is not correct. They will give you an answer more often than not that is not going to put that widow in a situation where she is financially secure. And they don't do it intentionally. They think about in their mind, they think, well, let's see, my mortgage is paid off, my kid's college education is paid off, a couple grand, and they really mean it that way. But yet, what you need to be able to figure out is say, well, you're right about the mortgage being paid off, so let's say that's $1,500 a month. You're spending five, which means once the mortgage is paid off, you still need $3,500. If we're only gonna leave two grand, how is she gonna make up for that $1,500 a month gap? And then listen. More often than not, they'll say, "Oh, that's a good point. It probably should be $3,500. Or they might say, "That's her problem, not mine. Two grand's enough." And all you want to do is understand what's important to them. So therefore, you got to hang in there and ask those questions. The other thing that you want to think through is how do you get them to really know what the actual number is? And here's how. Here's how I want you to ask that question, is that I would say, "Mr. Prospect, if you remember a few moments ago in the income section, we learned that your burn rate was $5,000 a month. So my next question for you is, in the unfortunate event that you don't make it home tonight, how much of that $5,000 a month would you want to be going onward for your spouse?" Now you've created the framework for them to ask the answer the question the right way. And that will be much more accurate for you. And then last but not least, what we need to do is we need to determine for how long. And that, once again, is not really up to you. Your job is just to know what's really important to them. And some people are gonna say, for the rest of her life. And some people are gonna say, for 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. You just need to understand what is important to them. By asking them that question, they can tell you. The other thing you wanna be prepared for is, I would say the most common response I got in the field is they would look at me and say, "Jim, I've never thought about that. What do most of your clients do? Or what should I do?" And there's not really a great answer to that because every human being is different. But if a client said that to me, I would say probably the most common is to be able to take what you're spending now, take that out until 65, and then lower it by about 20% and take that out until their life expectancy. That was a good template to be able to have as to figuring out for how long their income should be. So just be prepared to be able to address some, what I would call, radical answers you might get to that question. When I'm talking about income replacement, you can get people to say, "Ah, she's super well educated, she could go back to work, pay off the debt, pay off college, she's on her own." And if that's the truth, then your job is to tell them what it takes to do that. But if that's just a flippant answer, you might want to hang in there a little bit longer and say, tell me more about that. Do you really feel that way? Is that how you want me to put your plan together? In a way that will get them to think a little bit about that. So those are some great tools and resources to be able to get the third dimension of the purpose of life insurance, which is income replacement, accurate enough
so that you can do an appropriate plan for them around life insurance needs. Good luck with that. So now that we've figured out with our prospective client what it is that they need to have in life insurance as it relates to paying off debt, paying off future college costs, and providing for survivor income, now what we've got to do is we've got to be able to put it into what I like to call a mirror that we can hold up and show them. But let me just take a step back and help you understand that you need to know that net present value number right then and there in that meeting. So therefore, if you are good with numbers and you know how to use a calculator, that's great. If not, you should have some sort of sheet, a cheat sheet in your briefcase that'll show you what it takes. So use simple math. Let's just assume for now that they told you that they want to leave $5,000 a month until their spouse's life expectancy. You use 85 for that age, which means that, you know, for the next 50 years, they need to send $5,000 a month. And you look at your chart, and let's just make up a simple number and say that number is $1 million, okay? So now we put that down. Here's the way that I want you to have the holding up the mirror conversation with the client. So, Mr. Prospect, we just found out that in order to pay off all your debt, if something happens to you tonight, we need $200,000 to do that. In order to put your three-year-old son through the college of your choice, we need $100,000 in today's dollars to do that. In order for you to send $5,000 a month to your spouse for the next 50 years, that will take $1 million. So therefore, Mr. Prospect, we add that up. Your number is $1,300,000. And you currently have $300,000 through your employer. So therefore, your shortage today, as it relates to what we just discussed, is $1 million. Before I go any further, tell me, Mr. Prospect, how do you feel about that? Now, you really want to know that in that meeting. What you don't want is you don't want surprises. You don't want to gather all this information, go back to your office, and then come back in the next meeting and blow them away with something that they didn't expect. You don't want to waste your time, and you don't want to do that to them. You want to know right now, how you feeling about that? And some people, although it'll be a small percentage, will say, you know what? I've never gone through a process like that. That makes sense. But that'll be small. Most of them, if it's the first time they've ever gone through a process like that, will be somewhat in sticker shock, so to speak. They'll be blown away. They might have a feeling really quickly like, wow, my wife would be better off if I die. I mean, she's gonna get $1.3 million. She's gonna be rich. And you want them to verbalize that. And when I feel that, or especially if they say that, that's when I would teach them my bucket analogy. I thought it was really important for them to know that. And so how I would do that is I would say, you know what, Mr. Prospect, I can understand why you feel that way, but let me tell you a little bit about my bucket analogy. There's two different buckets, and they both have, in your case, let's say $1 million in them. The first bucket, what that title of that bucket is windfall profit. The second bucket, the title of that bucket is called lifetime income, okay? In both buckets, we're dropping $1 million into them, but they're different. You see, in the windfall profit bucket, you didn't lose your job. You're super healthy, alive, and working, and gonna work for 30 more years plus, and you just got a windfall profit. You won the lottery. You are a happy camper, and that is a lot of money. But now let's go to the other bucket. But in order to drop that $1 million in that bucket, you have to sign in blood that you can never work another day for the rest of your life. You can never add another dollar to the kitty. So now instead of being able to take the $1 million out of the bucket, what you get in order for it to last for another 50 years is $1,618 a month. Now, your lifestyle right now is living on $5,000 a month, and you're trying to figure out, how do I possibly live on just $1,600? Both buckets, the same amount of principal, but yet totally different perspective. Your job is to give your clients that perspective, and I was most effective by doing that with the bucket analogy. Last but not least, if I still felt that there was some stress or some anxiety, because now they're coming to grips that, holy cow, my number is $1 million, but how much is that gonna cost? Because they've never shopped it before. I'll say, you know what? Don't worry about the premium. The reality is, if you don't smoke and you're in good health, you can get this amount in inexpensive term insurance to begin with for less than your cable bill. The premium is not the problem. The premium is the solution to the problem. So now let's transition into the disability income section of the FactFinder. And I like beginning with the end in mind. Let's talk about what are the objectives here. There's essentially three. The first one would be to understand in its entirety, with as much detail as you can, the current amount of disability that they have and any decisions that they made on disability and why they made those. So that's the first objective. The second objective is once we have all those facts, we want to hold up the mirror and show them the gap in the event that they should become disabled from an income standpoint so that they can see that. And then the third objective is to be able to discuss with them and engage deep enough in a dialogue to figure out whether or not it has professionally disturbed them enough with this new knowledge to be able to do something about it. So now let's talk about that. In the first area of what do you have? The truth of the matter is most people I find don't know. They know they have something. They know they have it through their employer, but they really don't know what it is. So step number one is you gotta figure it out. And the best way to do that is to get them to send you the benefit booklet so that you can look at it. But I wouldn't just leave it at that until you get the benefit booklet. I found more often than not, the standard group long-term disability policy usually kicks in after 6 months of short-term disability and usually provides for 60% of one's income. So I would say to that client, I would say, you know what? For now, let's make the assumption that you have what the majority of my clients have. And that is that you would have 60% of your income after 6 months. I like doing that with them so that I can illustrate this problem right then and there in the fact finder meeting. So don't wait until you get all those facts. And I would just simply say, when I get your benefit booklet and I read through it, if yours is different, we'll address those changes. But for now, let's just assume that. And then I would go in and I would use what I like to call like a chart, draw it on a yellow pad, on a piece of paper, on a napkin, whatever. One line would simply say, hey, right now, this is what you're bringing home. You're bringing home $6,000 a month net. And what would happen in the event of a disability based on your group disability plan is that income would go down to $4,000 a month. So therefore, the third line I'd show them would be the gap. It's a $2,000 a month gap in income. How do you feel about that? And I would want to address that. But in addition to that, I wouldn't just stop there. I really want them to understand that the disability occurring is a bigger problem than just the income gap. More often than not, they also lose all their benefits. And so you no longer can contribute to a 401k and have company match, which means that in the event that this is a permanent long-term disability, your retirement's gonna be really short. Second of all, even a bigger short-term problem is that if they lose their health insurance and they gotta go out and buy that on their own, it is really expensive. And then last but not least, the earning power, the purchasing power, no inflation factor in it. So you lose that, you lose the benefit of 401k and you lose the benefit of health insurance. This now becomes a real problem. And I want them to understand that. And our goal is to make sure that they're always going to be okay no matter what happens. Nobody wants to pay a little bit of premium for disability, but everybody wants to be secure. And so what we've got to do in this section is make them aware of something that up until they met us, they probably weren't. And we want to get them to the point where they're saying at this point in time, yes, that is something I want to take a look at next time you come back. Now let's shift to the discovery agreement. When I use that term, it's not a universal term, so let me be clear about what that means. A discovery agreement is a very clear, concise, compelling summary at the end of your fact finder meeting. It is a way for you to take, let's just say it was an hour, hour and 15, hour and a half long where you did this meeting and consolidate it in a way that is, like I said, very clear, very concise, and very compelling. This is a critical, critical step in the process that can never, ever be overlooked. Because here's a couple things I want you to realize. When you go in to a fact finder meeting and you spend an hour to an hour and a half with a potential client asking them all kinds of questions that nobody's ever asked them before, there is a high likelihood that their head is spinning. They're feeling overwhelmed. They're feeling things like, boy, this was a lot. And if all you're doing is asking a bunch of questions, gathering a bunch of, you know, things like feelings, emotions, facts, numbers, then they don't really know, okay, now where do we go with this? What's next? You know, they feel that you asked them a lot of great questions, but they're just kind of don't know how to connect the dots, so to speak. So therefore, the purpose of the discovery agreement is to be able to give an executive summary in a way that makes sense to the client, in a way that also makes it very, very clear about what are we gonna do next time we're together. And then last but not least, and an important part, is compelling. What it is giving them the vision of having some excitement around seeing their plan. So that's really important to do at this point in time. So I'll give you an example of that with hypothetical client name and some hypothetical scenarios, just to put into action what I'm talking about when I say a discovery agreement. However, before I do this, I want you to pay attention to some of the clues that I'm going to give you ahead of time to add to that third component, which is compelling. I'm not just stating the facts, okay? What I'm doing is making comments like, what my clients love about this, what you're gonna really love about seeing this. I'm building the desire up while I'm also sharing the facts. So here's what I would say at the end of a fact finder. I'd say, you know what, Mrs. Prospect, I really appreciate your time. And it was really a pleasure and a privilege for me to get to know you as well as I have. And therefore, what I wanna do though is today, it's been a lot. It's been a lot of information. So if you're okay with it, what I'd like to do is I'd like to just give you a summary of what I think I heard from what it is that you shared with me, so that before I leave, A, I wanna make sure I didn't miss anything, and B, we're on the same page. Are you okay with that? And they say, sure. They never have not said yes, that they're okay with that. So I'd say at the very beginning, you know, I learned a lot about your story. You shared with me the story of your mom and dad and how much different it is watching them in retirement than your husband's mom and dad. You learned about how impactful it was to plan ahead of time and how peaceful that your in-laws' retirement is compared to the stress that your mom and dad are dealing with. And you had said that you had never really talked about that before. And I said that was important for me to understand if I was gonna apply for the job of being your planner. So I appreciate you sharing that story. And then the first section we started out with was taking a look at your life insurance needs. And what you learned was that in addition to what it is that you had through your employer, that you were short another $1 million in order to accomplish the things that you told me were really important for you to accomplish. And that was a big number at first for you. It was a little bit hard to kind of take that in. But as you understood that bucket analogy, it made sense to you. Next time we get together, I'm gonna take a look and help and educate you at what we need to do to solve that gap. And then after that, we went into disability. And if you remember, you kind of thought disability was like health insurance. Either you had it and you were set, or you didn't have it and you had to go get it. But what I showed you with, based on your disability plan, that you had some significant gaps, not just in income, but in the potential of losing benefits. And you definitely told me that you want to look at what it's gonna take to be able to supplement that. So we'll do that. And then we get into the fun part. The fun part is that we keep you alive, healthy, and well for a long time. And we get you up to 30,000 feet and we take a look at retirement. And we take a look at what it is that you wanted to accomplish in order to live like your in-laws are living. And then we're gonna break down all the things you have going in your current benefits. And if you don't change a thing, what I'm gonna show you is where the gap is. But then what you're gonna love about seeing this is for the first time ever, you're gonna know what it takes to get an A in retirement planning. In the past, you shared with me that it was kind of like the elephant in the room that you didn't want to talk about because you were so scared that you were going to be so short. What this plan is going to show you is that in addition to what you're already doing, if you save X amount of additional dollars, you'll be okay. My clients love seeing that because they've never known that number before. And then last but not least, we looked at education. It was really important to you to take your 5-year-old and 3-year-old and put them through the school that you and your husband met at. And we're gonna take a look at exactly what that school costs, what its historical inflation rate has been. Therefore, we're gonna know what it's gonna cost when your children get to that age of 18 and go there. And then we're gonna take a look at what it's gonna take to get an A. What do you need to set aside year after year after year in order to be in a position to fully fund their education. My clients love seeing that as well. So, Mrs. Prospect, when we come back, that's the plan that I'm going to present to you. That's the information that we're going to cover. Before I leave today, is there anything that I've missed or anything that you would like to add? Now, at this time, if you're doing a really good job with that, first and foremost, it's going to impress the heck out of them. Because what they're going to do is they're going to feel that they've been heard. If you're not looking at the fact finder form and you're able to recite what it is you just talked about for the last hour, hour and a half with them, that tells them that they were heard. It tells them that you care enough to listen, and it tells them that you really understand them. It also tells them you're professional for a couple reasons. Number one, you just illustrated that you're very thorough. But number two, that you cared enough to do that just in case there's something you missed, that they could inform you of that. So you're very, very, very professional. And last but not least, when they hear all of that, they wanna see it. They wanna see it. I kinda use the analogy when I'm teaching out in the field to say, you know, if you had something that wasn't quite well with your health, and you went in and the doctor said, you know, I think everything's fine, but just to be safe, I wanna do a blood test. And you do, you give a blood sample. You don't leave thinking, you know, hey, whenever you figure it out, just call me, doc. I mean, you wanna know those results. You were like, am I okay? What's happened? What are the results of that test? And you want your clients to feel that way as well. Once they have given you all this information, you want them, so to speak, on the edge of their seat, saying, when are we gonna get back together? I wanna see that plan. That's the position you want them to be in. And when you become really effective at the discovery agreement, you will do that very, very effectively. And that can be a game changer in your practice. Good luck with that. So now that you've listened to my discovery agreement and you have an idea of what a discovery agreement is, and you also heard me say how important it is to do it, I have found in the field in training that there are really two reasons why people do not do a discovery agreement. The first is the fact that they don't know how to. They don't have language. They've never been taught it. And so as it relates to that, you can certainly steal mine, which you just heard, or you can sit down and write your own that's authentic to you. But you must be able to practice it and rehearse it. The reason I could do mine in this film studio is because I've done it 10,000 times in real life, and therefore I know how to do it. And so you have to embrace the concept of repetition is the motherhood of all learning. You need to practice it and practice it and practice it to the point that you can do it in your sleep. And so the overall framework of your discovery agreement really won't change from one client to the next. The detailed numbers and maybe some of their story that you put in it will change, but the framework of it will be the same. And the order in which you go through it should be the same. So therefore, you have to practice it, you have to get it down, and then you will have the tools to do it. The second is a deeper problem. The second is the fact that a lot of people I meet are overwhelmed by that because they almost feel as if the purpose of the fact finder is just to stay in a completely logical world, gather a bunch of information, almost like it's an interrogation, get all the facts on a piece of paper, take it back to their office, put it in their computer, and then the computer spits out the plan, and then and only then do they go back with that plan and show it to the client. In other words, they need the computer and the software to do the work that they're not doing in their head. And what I'm telling you is that you've got to be able to do that live and on the spot, where you can tell them, hey, when I come back, the plan I'm going to do is going to be much more specific, but here's a basic outline of what we just talked about, and break it down for them. That is going to be really, really important. And what that means is it means that you've got to stay in the moment. You've got to be listening. You've got to be able to put a check in the box mentally as you start in survivor income, check in the box, you know, get to education, check in the box, retirement, disability. That is going to be a really important tool for you. And I'll tell you this, is that when I'm out in the field and I get some of these advisors to do this well, they'll come back to me and they'll say things like, Jim, not only has doing the discovery agreement transformed my business, it's also made me a much better fact finder. Because I now know going into the fact finder that I have to do the discovery agreement. And so therefore, I've become such a better listener because I realize ahead of time that if I don't listen and listen well, I'm not gonna be able to do it. So I want you to experience that same thing. So now that you're done with the discovery agreement, you can't leave. There's two other items you must do before you leave. The first one is you must set the date, the time, and the location for the next meeting. At all cost, you want to do everything you can to get that appointment on the books. It sets the tone. It tells the client that this is important. There's a sense of urgency there. So if my client looks at me at the end of that meeting and I try to do that, and they say, you know what, Jim, I'm busy for the next 2 weeks. Call me in a couple of weeks. You know, that's not something I want to take at face value. So I want to say, you know what, I'm super busy as well. And it's very inefficient for me to reach out and play phone tag with you. So let's do this. Let's take an educated guess as to what works. Let's put a stake in the ground right here, why I'm here with you now, and then we'll have that meeting on the books. They might say that, hey, I want my spouse at the meeting and I don't know her calendar. So what we'll want to do then is we want to just say, hey, you know your spouse's calendar fairly well. Let's make an educated guess and let's put a stake in the ground and get a meeting on the books. And if something happens when you get back and talk to her and it doesn't work out, call me. We'll change it. But let's at least make that attempt. So that's number one. And then number two is you want to make sure that you clearly communicate any outstanding items that still remain. So throughout the course of your fact finder, anytime you ask the question that they said they didn't know, like their group disability benefits or a life insurance policy that they bought or how much is in their 401k or how it's allocated, you are making notes of it and then you want to verbalize that to them in a fashion that says, hey, in the next 48 hours, these are the four things we agreed you were going to get me. Is there any reason that you can't get it to me in that timely of a fashion? So there you have it. Make sure you do those two things after the discovery agreement before you leave every time. So there you have it, the fact-finding system, the 9-step process to becoming a masterful fact-finder. I want you to use this one-pager two ways. If you've just listened to all 9 of the steps, you've already done the first way, and that is the initial learning, what I like to call the how-to. You can go through and look at everything I taught you in each one of those 9 steps. But the second way I want you to use this is on an ongoing basis into the future as a self-diagnostic tool. So that 6 months from now, 6 years from now, you can come back to this one pager, grade yourself on each one of the 9 stages on, let's say, a scale of 0 to 5, and look at what are the ones you're doing really well and where's the low-hanging fruit that you've totally gotten away from. And that's how this one pager was designed, and that's how I want you to use it. So just as a quick review, step number one, probably the most difficult for a lot of people, is leave your needs at the door. This isn't about you. It is about your prospective client. You want them to feel like they are the only thing that exists on the planet and you are there for them. And you are a great listener and you leave all your problems and your agendas outside that door and you become totally engrossed with them in that moment. Step one. Step two is begin with your approach. The approach that is full of DNA. It's different, it's new, it's attractive. It's the way that you describe what you do, how you do it, and why you do it. Get to the point that your approach is down, that you are really good at delivering it. Not only just the language, but the body language, the tone in your voice, the smile on your face. That was our second step. The third step, or what I like to call the third stage. That is bringing intentionality to your practice by starting every single thing you do, understanding that the ultimate outcome that you want to achieve is for your prospective client to think and feel 3 things about you. First is that you really, really understand them in a deep level. Second of all, is that you genuinely care about them and what you do for a living. And the third is that you're very knowledgeable in your craft, in your profession. When you leave a meeting and that prospective client says that you really understand them, you really care about them, and you're really good and smart at what you do for a living, the rest of it is all downhill. So make sure that you bring intentionality with those 3 things to everything you do. The fourth step, taking a look at the snapshot versus the movie in the assets and liability, and really understanding how to ask questions to the questions to the questions. And so you really truly understand in income as well, the story behind all of the numbers. The fifth step, understanding how to ask enough questions so that you can help them hold up a mirror in the meeting in the areas of retirement planning, survivor income, and educational planning. So right then and there, you're able to gather where they're at, what their goals and objectives are, and have a meaningful conversation by holding up a mirror through all the data that you've been able to gather in that meeting. The sixth step, really understanding that disability income section to the point that you can give them knowledge and information that more often than not, they did not know prior to you getting there. That you can help them understand what they have and where the gap would be in the event of a disability, not only financially from an income standpoint, but from the loss of benefits. And then step seven, for you to be able to have a system and a process that throughout the meeting, you're gathering all the outstanding requirements, where you're asking questions and they're giving you answers that they don't know, and you're letting them know that it's important to know and that you need them to get that information to you. You're gathering all of that so that you can share that with them and request for them to get that back to you in a very timely fashion. The eighth step. I don't like to say the most important one because that makes a statement that the rest aren't as important, but this is a big one. And this is one that's gonna take a lot of practice and a lot of effort on your behalf. And that's the discovery agreement. And you must be able to do this in a way that's clear and concise and compelling. And it also must build desire for the client to wanna come back and see the plan. You must practice this. You must work on this. It's really important. And as I taught you, you must be able to do it without looking at the fact finder. When you're done with it, I used to always put it away in my briefcase, be able to look at them in the eye and verbalize that discovery agreement. It blows them away. It tells you that you care. It tells them that you care. And they totally feel as if they've been heard and been listened to. That's the eighth step. And the ninth step, never ever leave a meeting where you don't set up the date, the time, and the location for the next meeting. Don't take excuses. People will try to avoid it if they don't want to address the issues. Your job is to keep sense of urgency right in front of them. And when you leave a meeting and say, this is important, we got to get the next one on the books, it's going to set that tone. So there you have it. There's your nine stages of becoming a masterful fact finder. Good luck with all of them.